Hey guys, Adrian here from the 1PM crew. Friendly reminder, if you're currently a UWA medical student in MD2, please complete the survey that's been going around, available in your emails and all your socials. Thank you.
Welcome to the 1PM show. Today we've got a new presenter. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hello everybody, this is Josh, back again and in the driving seat today, which is quite nice.
Yeah.
And we've got two other guests joining us today. Do you want to say hello guys?
So I'm Jay. It's my second episode. Quite excited to be here.
And I'm Nien, MD3. Nice to be here.
Beautiful. And the topic of today is sepsis. So to kick things off, I thought we'd just start by going over the definitions of sepsis or septicemia. So does anyone want to have a go at defining sepsis?
Is it a life-threatening reaction to bacterial infection?
Close, yes. So
I've got one.
Oh yeah, go on. Bugs and blood.
Making body not good.
Great, fantastic. That was a nice try.
Yeah.
But there's actually just recently been a new definition of sepsis that has been defined in some guidelines called the Sepsis 3 guidelines. And that definition is that sepsis is a life-threatening condition characterized by signs and symptoms of organ dysfunction caused by a dysregulated immune response to infection. So throwing it back to you, Jason, does that necessarily mean we have bugs in blood, do you think?
Well, I guess not now.
Yes. So that's a good distinction to make, is the difference between sepsis and bacteremia. And that's something that when I kind of think back on my revision, something that I can get confused about.
Just to clarify, you can have sepsis without bacteria in your blood.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay.
So bacteremia is simply just the state where there's bacteria in the bloodstream. So patients with bacteremia aren't necessarily septic, and patients who are septic don't necessarily have bacteria in their bloodstream. So I thought it might be interesting just to think about, if bacteria in the bloodstream isn't the only cause of sepsis, what do you guys think some other causes might be?
An abscess somewhere?
Sure. Yep.
UTI?
Sure. Yep. So UTI, and you're thinking like organs that are highly perfused, because the issue with sepsis, which we'll come to, is that it's not necessarily bacteria in the bloodstream, but it's a high level of circulating immune molecules, right? That causes the disease, and sepsis causes the condition.
Pneumonia?
Absolutely. Pneumonia is actually the most common cause of sepsis, which makes sense when you think about it, because it's a really vascular organ. Like 100% of your blood will at some point pass through the lungs.
Okay, so it's more about the inflammatory molecules which are traveling around the body.
Exactly, not necessarily the bacteria, but the inflammatory molecules that react to the bacteria. So pneumonia is one. We've talked about abscess, we've talked about urinary tract infections. So ordinarily we'd think more pyelonephritis, because that's higher up and that's usually a more severe infection.
Would you still say bacteremia is the most common cause of sepsis?
In this one study that I was looking at, pneumonia without bacteremia is more common, I believe.
Okay.
Because like you said, it's not necessarily the bacteria in the blood causing the problem. It's the circulation of these immune molecules around the bloodstream and cause havoc everywhere without the bacteria necessarily disseminating as well.
Okay. It makes a lot more sense now.
I didn't realize that. Yeah, crazy.
Shit, man, I should have known this.
So just going back over, so the five most common sources of infection and sepsis are pulmonary, so pneumonia, intra-abdominal sources, so there'd be things like diverticulitis, cholecystitis, cholangitis, blood, so bacteremia, skin, cellulitis and abscesses, and urinary, like pyelonephritis. So considering that sepsis really starts with infection, let's try and think about what risk factors there might be for sepsis.
Gonna go for the big one here, immunocompromised.
Absolutely, that's a great one.
I was gonna say an MD2 attempting a cannula.
Yes, 100%, 100%. Story of my life. Yeah. So you're right, improper cannulation, that's a breaking the skin barrier, but what else
Make
might?
Make sure you do your online modules for that, hey?
Absolutely. And not just the click, click, click. Yeah. next.
Yeah, you better take the full 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Could you say things like SLE and
autoimmune
conditions?
Sure. Because often when you have those autoimmune conditions, what are you given?
Steroids.
Steroids. So yeah, long-term steroid use, that's a risk factor.
Like with any risk factor, old age.
Old age, absolutely. But not just old age. We're just talking about this.
Kids?
Yes, that's right. So interestingly, from my time in PEDS, something that I remember very fondly is we had... Something I remember very clearly from my time in pediatrics was we had a febrile 9-month-year-old, and my registrar asked me, Josh, like, what are your top three differentials for this kid? I don't know. I said something like pneumonia, appendicitis, gastro or something. And he's like, nah, mate, your top three differentials are sepsis, sepsis and sepsis for any febrile.
Well, that's just one difference.
Yeah, well, I remember it now, don't I?
Yeah. Don't miss sepsis.
Like intubation, ventilation sort of thing?
Surely, yeah, because that's like an invasive foreign body that can be a site for infection, right? So I'm a massive fan of acronyms.
Massive.
Oh. A massive, huge, huge fan. And here at 1PM, we like to keep things quite basic. So I've actually got an acronym for the risk factors of sepsis, and that is basic. So B stands for burns and birth, because instrumentation and retained products that can increase your likelihood of developing infection. A stands for age, less than 2, over 65. S for surgery. I for immunosuppression, whether that be by drugs or chemotherapy or radiotherapy. Also for intravenous drug use. And finally, C for chronic illness. So what kind of chronic illnesses do you think might predispose someone to infection?
Liver failure, renal failure.
Absolutely. Yep, all your failures pretty much. So yeah, well done, guys. I just briefly wanted to touch on the pathophysiology of sepsis and go over, disgustingly, the immunology associated with sepsis, because it actually really helps when you start to think about the clinical features. We're going to focus mainly on the innate immune system. So cast your mind back the 3-4 years. So obviously the first step when it comes to the pathophysiology of sepsis is infection. So the host is infected by a pathogen. Second step is the pathogen is recognized by sentry white blood cells. And that can be things like macrophages, neutrophils, mast cells, dendritic cells. And the third step is that these sentry white blood cells are activated. Can anyone remember anything about what they might do when they're activated?
They release, I don't know which chemicals or cytokines.
Absolutely, but they would, yep.
Like make the blood vessels leaking.
Exactly right.
So they can get to, from the blood vessel to the sites.
That's exactly right. Okay. Perfect.
Yeah.
So
cytokine storm.
That's read my mind.
Yeah.
So the first thing they do, as Ian rightly said, is they call for help and they release cytokine, and that recruits more white blood cells. But then they've got all these white blood cells coming in, can't get from the blood and into the tissues. So they increase tissue accessibility. Does anyone remember what that molecule is that causes vasodilation and increased tissue permeability?
Is it produced by an inflammasome?
The molecule?
Yeah.
Is it prostaglandin?
It rhymes with schmitrous schmoxide.
Nitrous oxide.
Yes, boom.
Wow.
Well done, nitrous oxide. So far we've said cytokine release, nitrous oxide release, which causes increased tissue permeability and vasodilation. And the third thing that these activated sentry white blood cells will do is they'll begin a crude antimicrobial response. So before we recruit the adaptive immune system, where we get the CD4 and B cell and all that stuff, which I don't know about, these white blood cells release things like reactive oxygen species and enzymes that will damage the microorganism but can also have off-target effects at the local tissues. So the fourth step after infection, recognition, activation, the fourth step, what really makes sepsis happen, is a progression from a local to a systemic immune response, where those three things that we just mentioned happen on a systemic level. So if you have systemic release of these cytokines, you're going to have systemic recruitment of white blood cells, which are then going to release more cytokines and then generate that positive feedback loop. So
would you say it's an inappropriate response to the infection?
It's hard to say that it's inappropriate, right? Because it is an appropriate response to an infection, because that's what you want.
Yeah.
You want these things to happen, but it's almost like an overreaction, I suppose. So let's say you have a systemic release of nitrous oxide where at a local level it causes vasodilation and increased permeability. Mm. What effect might that have on a systemic level, do you think?
Hypovolemia.
Because the fluid goes from inside the blood vessels to outside.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Widespread edema. That's one. That's really
widespread edema, baby.
That's really the driving pathological process. Yeah. There are a few other things that happen, but it's that widespread edema. Mm. That can you think of anywhere in particular that you wouldn't want edema to happen?
In your lungs.
Exactly right. Because if you have pulmonary edema, that can lead to
reduce the ventilation.
Exactly right. Resulting in hypoxemia.
Yeah.
Mm. And it's this hypoxemia that then causes hypoxia at your end organs, and that causes end organ dysfunction.
Yeah.
Right?
Is that why your tissues die in sepsis? Because of this?
Exactly.
Oh, I thought it was the total body, like vasodilation, causes a drop in blood pressure.
That's a second part. Oh. So the vasodilation causes a drop in blood pressure.
Yeah.
So both of those two things, the drop in blood pressure, reduced cardiac output.
Mm. But quickly, what's the difference between hypoxia and hypoxemia? Because all the internal med consultants love asking that.
Hypoxemia is, well, EBM means presence in blood.
Yeah, so hypoxemia is when there's not enough oxygen in the blood. And hypoxia is when there's not enough oxygen in the tissue.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And commonly hypoxemia will lead to hypoxia. Just to recap, when you get this systemic release of nitric oxide, what are the two things that happen?
Vasodilation.
So what does vasodilation cause?
Reduce intravascular blood volume.
Which leads to what?
Which leads to hypovolemia.
Yeah, and so, at the lungs.
Oh, reducing tissue perfusion. Oh, and the other one, pulmonary edema.
Right.
And then what does pulmonary edema lead to?
Hypoxemia and then hypoxia.
Yeah,
exactly.
Love and that. That's a nice flowchart.
The first principles are coming out.
Yeah. Yes, big time, big time. And for bonus points, if your tissues are hypoxic and they no longer have oxygen to use for metabolism, what are they going to do?
Yeah, so whoever answers these questions gets to actually appear in another episode.
Anaerobic metabolism.
Okay.
I'm a bit keen there, geez.
Follow-up question. This is for the gold medal. What are they then going to produce as a byproduct?
Lactate.
Oh, man trying to get this. Jeez.
That's right. Which is really important to think about because, as we'll discuss later, measuring a patient's lactate is one of the most important things you can do when investigating them for sepsis.
What does lactate do to the blood, Nian?
Degrees pH.
Yeah, which is...
metabolic acidosis.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Really well done. So the last thing we're going to talk about, which only happens in about 35% of patients, so we'll just go over it really quick. Okay. So remember when we talked about like the three things that the white cells do, they call for help, release nitrous oxide. They also release these noxious chemicals. When that happens on a systemic level, it causes damage to the endothelial layer of blood vessels. Does anyone want to have a guess at what that would then do or what that would then activate?
The coagulation cascade.
Yeah, system-wide activation of the extrinsic clotting cascade, which causes coagulation or clotting, right?
Yep.
Everywhere inside your blood vessels.
Not good.
Like disseminated.
Bad.
Intravascular.
Bad. Okay. You don't need to hype it up anymore, man. Yeah, true.
And that leads to disseminated intravascular coagulation, like the condition, right?
Okay, cool.
Good old DIC.
So then once you have all these blood clots forming, your fibrinolytic pathways activate because you're like, no, this is bad. We don't want these. This is cutting off all, you know. Too much coagulation. It's causing thrombus in all these small blood vessels and causing ischemia elsewhere. Very bad. So then they activate the fibrinolytic pathway. And when both of these things are going on, you get this weird paradoxical state where you have clots forming, but because you have these fibrinolytic pathways getting activated everywhere, you have a deficiency in your clotting factors and your platelets. So you can have clots forming, but you can also have hemorrhage.
Interesting.
Just remember, that doesn't happen in every single patient.
35%.
35%.
Not
35. That's right.
35.
Not 36.
35%.
Okay. All right. So from that, let's start to think about how septic patients might present. So he said the first thing that has to happen is there has to be an infection. What are some clinical features of infection?
Febrile.
Boom.
Low blood pressure.
Good.
Confusion.
Absolutely.
Tachycardic.
Sure. Yep, that's good. And it really kind of depends. So there are these general kind of features, you know, tachycardic, febrile. They could have rigors, they could have night sweats. But then beyond that, it kind of depends on what system might be involved. So let's say the respiratory system is involved.
Accessory muscle use.
Accessory muscle use.
Something. It's just going on my idea now.
Signs of respiratory distress.
Yes. Yes.
You could also
tracheal tug. Yeah, tracheal tug.
Tracheal
yeah.
tug.
Added sounds, breath sounds, stridor, wheeze, that kind of stuff.
Abdominal breathing.
Nasal flaring.
Nasal flaring.
Exactly. Tripodding. Right. Head bobbing.
My goodness gracious, you guys are just too much.
Wheeze. All right,
and let's say you had an infection of your brain, of your meninges. What else might you present with?
It's a mental status.
Yep.
Yep, confusion. Yep.
Exactly.
Non-blanching purpuric rash.
Yep. Exactly right. Good, you guys are killing it. Let's say you had like a genitourinary infection. What might you have?
Suprapubic tenderness.
Boom.
Reduce urine output.
Exactly.
Dysuria.
Dysuria. See, you guys are getting it. But that's almost what makes it difficult is that because you can have an infection in all these different systems, the breadth of things that a patient can present with is there's a lot of different things. For that reason, it makes it kind of hard to pinpoint specific clinical features, right?
Yeah.
Okay. The next pathological process, hypotension. If someone's hypotensive, how would their heart respond?
Tachycardic.
Exactly. Moving on. Widespread edema.
Look a bit swollen.
Classically, with septic patients, they're described as flushed and mottled with warm peripheries.
Okay. Oh, mottled. They love that. Yeah, boom. Yeah.
All this fluid from the blood vessels are leaking into their skin and warming it up. And if they've already got a fever, it's going to be warm. And they've got pulmonary edema. What kind of examination findings might you expect?
Crackles.
Crackles, exactly. With that, so you have end organ dysfunction as well. So then you're going to have all the signs and symptoms associated with your failures, your heart failures, your kidney failures, your respiratory failure, your liver failure, all the failures. I guess brain failure isn't a thing, but like you'll have altered mental status and like decreased GCS, right?
That is brain failure.
Yeah, I have brain failure often. So we've just touched on so many different things and so many different ways a septic patient might present. So I thought it might just be useful to categorize maybe the top five presentations that they might have. So does anyone have a stab at what's one of the most important things that all these patients are probably going to have?
A low blood pressure.
Do you want to define hypotension for me?
Is it below 90 systolic?
Yep.
And is it 60 diastolic?
Yep, 60 okay. diastolic, great. And also a mean arterial pressure below 65, but who really cares about that? So yep, hypotension, something else?
Tachypnea.
Yes, and that is the most common sign. One of the things I was reading, it said that 99% of septic patients will have tachypnea.
Yeah, CJ, I go for the high yield ones.
Cool. And do you want to define tachypnea for me?
Depends on patient demographics.
In the adult, in the adult population.
Greater than or equal to 30. I don't know. 25, 30?
You got the high yield stuff wrong.
Okay.
I had 22, but...
22.
That's okay, all right. Shoot for the moon.
Confusion.
Yep, that's also in mine. And that's useful. We'll come back to that in just a second because that's useful for one of the scores that you might use for a septic patient.
Is lactate level one of them?
Absolutely. That is the most important investigation you can possibly do, maybe behind a blood culture, but I read that an elevated lactate is one of the earliest signs or indicators that a patient's going to sepsis. And finally, and maybe the most obvious thing that a person with infection will have.
Fever.
And do you want to define fever?
Above 38.
Love it. Jason, do you want to just go over those five things we just said?
Okay, so the five key signs for sepsis are hypotension.
Yep.
Tachypnea.
Yep.
Confusion.
Yep.
Raised lactate.
Good.
And fever.
Very well done. Yeah. Very nice.
Is there a specific lactate level we're worried about?
Above 2 mmol/L is classically the threshold, I suppose. Something that I've come across in my reading. You guys might have heard of it too.
You do a lot of reading, hey?
I did a lot of reading. I read often. Does anyone know a tool which might be used for septic patients?
Is it? I can see it, but is it QSOFA?
It's the QSOFA tool. That's right. And something that I long misunderstood was that I thought that QSOFA was a diagnostic tool. And the criteria, the three criteria in this QSOFA score, that being hypotension, altered mental state, and tachypnea, I thought, oh, like, that's so convenient. Like, three things, diagnosis of sepsis. But no, it's not what it is. It's a prognostic tool. You can use the QSOFA tool to identify patients who are more likely to suffer poorer outcomes as a result of sepsis.
Interesting.
And they are the HAT criteria, hypertension, altered mental state, and tachypnea.
So, yeah, you don't want to be getting 3 out of 3 for that.
You do not want to be getting 3 out of 3.
Not good.
Funnily enough, actually, bit of an aside, Q stands for quick SOFA score.
I always wonder what the Q stands for.
Right? So there is an extended SOFA score, and like our ID consultant the other day asked the question she asked Jerry was, Jerry, what's the SOFA score? And he was like, oh, it's hypertension, old mental status, tachypnea. And she's like, yeah, I want the SOFA score. And it's like 12 items long or something. Yep, great. This takes us on to one of our first principles, that being that no organ system is protected from the consequences of sepsis. So like we were discussing earlier, any organ system can be affected, and that means it can present in a lot of different ways. So when it comes to our investigations, we want to investigate widely. So starting off with bedside investigations, there is an infection going on. What kind of investigations do we want to consider?
Don't say MD calc, mate.
General obs.
General obs, yep. Underrated general obs. We'll take general obs.
Exam, not investigation. You're saying.
I'll take still high yield.
Vitals.
Vitals, yep. Vitals. Yeah. I'm taking it.
Just like the fancy way of saying obs.
Yeah, it is. Hey, mate, once you start that OSCE prep, they burn into your mind, these bedside tests. Okay, vitals, in the end.
ECG.
Good.
Nice.
Let's keep it going around the table.
Urinalysis or urine MCNS?
Oh, two for the price of one.
Urine MCS bedside must be nice.
Just get the urine from them.
That's where it comes from. I consider it bedside.
You get it on back the bedside. In my day, you get it at the bedside.
Come on, switch on, Jason.
Fuck, I'm done.
Can anyone else think of another one?
Lumbar puncture.
Yes. We're just talking.
What fucking bedside investigation are you?
Big time.
Okay, you get it on MRI bedside? Next? The bedside I know it may literally be in the next room. It doesn't mean it a bedside.
But you do the LP at the bedside, though.
I consider it bedside. And I'm the master, so. Sit down, Jason. You're not in charge this week.
So you're in your country, old country town. This patient comes in with possible sepsis. I mean, you're going to do a lumbar puncture.
If you're comfortable enough, go for it.
Respect. I would. That's ballsy. The last thing you might do at the bedside is collect a microbiological sample.
Yeah.
Such as?
Skin swabs, any wound swabs.
Exactly. Sputum, stool sample, joint aspirate.
Yeah, not freaking lumbar puncture.
Lumbar puncture counts.
It is a microbiological investigation.
So okay.
If you have to argue, mate.
Now let's move on to bloods. What blood tests do we want to order? And what did I say was the most important thing to look for on blood?
Lactate.
Yeah, boom. Do you know what the actual like blood order is to look at a lactate?
Serum lactate.
Yeah, but it's part of a wider test.
VBG?
VBG. Jay's going to come swooping in and save you at every turn of the corner.
I'll do it ABG, but that's just me.
And that's not ballsy, is it?
Yeah, ABG.
Okay, so VBG. And now I'll open the floor to whatever you kind of...
Simple, full blood count?
Yeah, well, keep going. Roll off the whole trifecta.
Full blood count, CRP, LFT, US, UEC.
It's going to say USA.
Yeah.
And if you're worried that they might have DIC.
Grip and hold.
Coag.
Yep, amazing. And we like to just throw in BGL in there as well.
BGL?
BSL.
That's a bedside. I can't tell.
But it's his blood though.
Yeah. I know, but it's a bedside blood.
And you want to take blood cultures from two different sites. Imaging? What might we consider?
Chest x-ray? Yeah,
exactly.
You're welcome to the hospital chest x-ray.
Here's your daily dose.
Yeah, daily dose.
Cool. And some miscellaneous imaging that you might do, say, for...
If you believe it, maybe an intra-abdominal infection, you may do an abdo CT.
Beautiful.
For any collections.
What might you do at the bedside before you did an abdo CT?
We just fucking went through the bed.
But what? The radiologist is like, I'm not putting radiation in this
MRI
person.
At the bedside.
You can use sound waves, man.
Oh, ultrasound.
Exactly. And CT. That's really well done, guys. So
What was it really?
It was really well done. Yeah, you got all the things on my list. Screen.
Actually, I actually remember one bedside one you could do. COVID PCR.
Oh my god! I didn't include that.
I risk stratified. I care about bed management. You know,
why are you looking at me when you say that?
Okay. Moving on. Included in that was your septic screen, which we already mentioned, including the urine MCS, the lumbar puncture, blood cultures, and chest X-ray. Moving on to management of sepsis and another first principle, and that being time is critical in sepsis management. And there's something that we love called the golden hour, where if a patient has suspected or confirmed sepsis, you have to start antimicrobial therapy within 1 hour. Or bad things happen.
Regardless of the cause of the sepsis?
Yep. Now, has anyone heard of the Sepsis 6?
A lot of acronyms in this.
I can't help it. I'm a very simple person. I'm very simple minded.
I was actually asked this by an RMO in ED.
If that's the case, do you want to run us through?
I can't remember it, but
sure. I guess you're paying attention there.
So you do, I think it's fluids.
Yep.
Antibiotics.
Great.
You do a VBG.
Maybe.
Blood cultures?
That's definitely is.
Come on, Jason, you're the smart one here.
Hey, I didn't say that.
Well, let's just think back. Like, what are the main pathological processes happening? We know.
So you're correcting hypovolemia. So fluids is done. Antibiotics is done.
Anticoagulation.
If they've got DIC, but that's not part of the sepsis 6, but I like your thinking. If you're doing a VBG and you're checking their lactate, they're going through anaerobic metabolism, which means that they've
oxygen.
Got, yeah. Boom. So you replace the oxygen. And the sixth thing that you do?
Patient education. I'm just so holistic.
Patient education.
I'm tundered on the bed.
Yeah, got to tell little Tommy.
Here's a pamphlet.
No more playing in the dirt, okay? No more scratching your leg.
Non-pharmacological management.
And the sixth thing is you want to monitor their fluid status. So you want to measure their urine output, as well as, you know, reassess their vital signs and continually reassess them.
Who wants to repeat them? Septic 6.
Yeah, I can do that. So, sepsis 6, blood cultures, lactate, oxygen, fluids, antimicrobials, and measure urine output.
That was spot on. So, is there anything I can add about those sepsis 6? Like we mentioned earlier, when you're taking blood cultures, you want to take them from two separate sites because this reduces, I guess, the effect of potential contamination. And something else, you want to take this blood culture before you do what?
Give antibiotics.
Good, because we like high yield blood cultures. Monitor their lactate, because really high lactate is associated with poor outcomes. You want to give them O2 therapy. Do you have any idea what their O2 sats, what we want them to sit around?
92,
96. 94? 92. Sure. 95 to 98.
Wait, so is it 95, I guess?
95 to 98 in the guidelines that I have. And then we want to give them IV fluids, and that's going to increase your cardiac output. Any guesses at what fluids you might want to give?
Saline?
Yep. You want to give normal saline at 30 mils per kilo, and you want to give it in boluses rather than an infusion, because you want to aggressively try and restore hemodynamic stability. Mm-hmm. Lastly, you want to monitor their urine output. And how might we do that?
Catheter and fluid balance chart.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Okay.
What's minimum urine output?
That's my next question.
0.5 mils per kilogram per hour.
Oh my God.
My man.
Jeez Louise. And now let's talk about antibiotics last. Going off ETG, we're looking at the guidelines for community-acquired sepsis of unknown origin, because this is the most common presentation of a septic patient. And the antibiotics you want to give in that case is gentamicin IV, flucoxacillin IV. If they're in septic shock, you want to add vancomycin to those two. And if you have a high degree of suspicion they've got Neisseria meningitidis infection, which would be things like the non-blanching rash, neck stiffness, photophobia, you also want to give them a healthy dose of IV ceftriaxone, because why not?
Wait, so gentamicin, flucoxacillin, vancomycin, and ceftriaxone if you think there's a risk of meningitis.
So the main two would be gent and flucox. If they're really unwell, you add vanc. And if you think they have Neisseria meningitis infection, you add KEF.
Yeah, I think in the OSCE, I'm just going to say refer to guidelines.
Yep. Well, we go above and beyond here at 1 p.m. So you do you.
Yeah.
So that's the sepsis 6. I'm just quickly going to touch on the complications of sepsis. So one that we've already discussed is DIC. Another one that we've already discussed is hypotension. And if you have really severe hypotension associated with tachycardia and your tissues aren't meeting the metabolic requirements, what's that state called?
Shock.
Shock, exactly. Yeah, septic shock. And then DIC, sepsis, septic shock can cause organ dysfunction and organ failure. And if you have a bunch of organs going crook at the same time, you have a syndrome called multiple organ dysfunction syndrome. And does anyone want to take a stab at what the mortality rate of a septic patient with MODS is?
95%.
Okay, well, okay. let's just reel it in. Just reel it in.
Antibiotics, you know. Like, geez.
Reel it in. But I like the enthusiasm. It's bad.
33%.
Mm-hmm. I love the specific nature to that.
63%.
No, it's at least 25%. But still, that's one in four patients. One in four patients.
Yes.
That's still one in four patients that are, you know, getting this and dying, which is really tough.
Yeah, so 25 out of 100, it's one quarter. Okay. Casey.
I had to mentally do that on my mental chalkboard very quickly chalkboard. To confirm. Okay. All right. And yeah, that's it, guys. So there are three key takeaways from this session today. Firstly, sepsis is a syndrome caused by the immune system's response to an infection, and it's characterized by those pathological processes that we described, that being hypotension, widespread edema, hypoxemia, and end organ dysfunction. Secondly, no organ system is protected from the consequences of sepsis. So because of that, it's very important that we investigate widely and we treat. And that leads us into our third key takeaway. When managing sepsis, we have to try to implement the sepsis 6 within that period of time called the ...
golden hour.
Golden hour. Everybody
together.
So that's everything. All right, everyone. So that wraps up our talk on sepsis. Thank you guys for joining me today. I think that was really good. You guys did really well. As always, you can check out more 1PM content on our streaming services and our website and socials for more information. And for all your first principles, keep it right here at 1PM.
Thank you so much for listening. We're really excited to be collaborating with Becky from Becky's Notes, a UK-based resource to produce an infographic for our visual learners out there. Becky's Notes bring together all the key topics medical students need to know in a readily available place, reviewed by specialists in the field. These visually striking notes are a refreshing change from all these boring textbooks out there. You can check her out on Instagram at Becky's Notes 01 and support her at the links below.